Hello and welcome to the Cycling Podcast. My name is Richard Moore and I'm joined by Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
A giggling, smirking Lionel Burney, I'm not sure why. And Daniel Freed, back from his travels and looking like David Duchovny.
Thanks, Rich. In the first take, you said someone else. It was a little less complimentary.
I changed my mind. So we've got lots to talk about today. We've got mainly the recent goings-on at the Giro d'Italia. A lot of controversy, stage 16, over the Stelvio and Gavia passes with snow disrupting the stage and causing some confusion about whether parts of the stage were neutralised or not. It didn't bother Nairo Quintana, the Colombian, who has been getting better and better as the race has gone on, and took off with Pierre Roland and Ryder Hesjedal improbably. It's difficult to tell which was the more impressive or extraordinary ride, Hesjedal or Quintana, really, on that stage. But Quintana took some time from Rigoberto Urán initially on the descent, and there's now a controversy raging about whether the race was in fact neutralised. Then, Lionel, what's your take on what went on?
Well, where to start? I think Daniel probably he's got a more kind of forensic grasp of the kind of the way events unfolded. Sorry, I'm setting you up for a fall there, Daniel. But we were talking about it a little bit before we started recording the podcast, and obviously everybody now is having their say about what happened, and you know, the fact that the one of the members of the race jury on a motorbike, who I believe, Daniel, was Marco Velo, the former pro who raced on Marco Pantani's team, he held out the red flag. An announcement was made over the radio to say that the descent of the Stelvio Pass would be neutralised and that nobody was to overtake the motorbike. Quintana and a couple of others did overtake the motorbike and gain some time on the descent, and then obviously stretched that lead out to sort of 4 minutes over Rigoberto Urán on the final climb up to the finish, and then the recrimination started. Watching it on the TV, it wasn't altogether clear that the race had been neutralised, and in fact in real time there were rumours that the race had been neutralised and then rumours that it hadn't been neutralised, and in fact the official Giro d'Italia Twitter feed corrected themselves and said no, there's no neutralisation of the race, and then the teams all say well there was. And then the following morning, before stage 17, almost unprecedented that all the directeurs sportifs would get together in a car park near the start, stand around in a circle and debate the situation. And of course, there you've got
a very low-rent scene, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean the pictures on Twitter made it look it looked like the sort of thing that you don't really imagine all of the Formula One team bosses sort of standing in the pits where they can be photographed while they're sort of discussing and debating this. And obviously, it appears that the directeurs sportifs have come up with they've come to a consensus that Quintana should be docked a bit of the time that he gained on the descent. The problem is that there's no provision for that in the rules of cycling with the UCI. The rules of cycling, as laid down by the governing body, they don't really make provision for every eventuality. But when you go through all of the rules, there is a particular rule. In fact, I'll read it out that covers this kind of event. Race incidents is a title, and basically, it gives the decision making to the commissaires to use their best judgment. It says, in case of an accident or incident that could impinge upon the normal conduct of a race director may, after obtaining the agreement of the commissaires panel and having informed the timekeepers, at any moment decide to either modify the course, temporarily neutralise the stage, declare the stage null and void, cancel part of the stage, let the result stand, or restart the race or stage, taking into account gaps recorded at the moment of the incident. And I think, you know, they must have had a bit of a quandary going up the Stelvio, but they, as Daniel and I were talking earlier, they left it all too late to come to any kind of decision as to what to do. They had probably best part of an hour to communicate to all of the teams and in the team cars that the Stelvio descent was going to be dangerous and was going to be neutralised, and they left it until the riders were virtually at the top. And by then, it was, you know, it would be very difficult to get that message to everybody in the race. And really, the only two options they had were to do what they did in Milan San Remo last year, get everybody to the top of the climb, put them in the buses and team cars. Well, it couldn't be the buses because the buses would have been at the finish, but put them in the team cars, take them to the bottom, and then set them off according to the time gaps that they had as they reached the top. Or let the race carry on and say, well, the race is open. Trying to neutralise it on a descent and to artificially keep gaps when, you know, okay, don't overtake the motorbike, but riders coming from behind could all catch back on. All the gaps could be, you know, taken out of the equation and everyone arrive at the bottom in one group.
A lot of confusion about the red flag, and we were discussing earlier, Lionel, that a red flag is not something that you generally see in a bike race. So it wasn't obvious, certainly, to the spectators. It wouldn't have been obvious to the riders, I guess, what it meant. You would imagine that it would mean danger and be careful, not do not overtake.
And that is the problem. I mean, my issue with everything that happened yesterday is not so much, you know, there's been a lot of finger pointing, a lot of apportioning of blame. I think the blame lies with a system, a protocol, whereby the language is imprecise. There are too many vagaries. For instance, yesterday, you know, Mara Venyi, so he's the race director, he's in constant communication with the president of the jury and the race radio announcer, who are in the same car. And Mara Venyi yesterday specified, or claimed to have specified, that he wanted the red flag raised because there was poor visibility on 6 to 7 hairpins, and this was purely going to be a sign to the riders to take care on that portion of the descent. Something was lost in translation. The race radio announcer took it to mean that the race was to be neutralised there, but he didn't even use the word neutralisation. He said that riders should stay in their current positions. Now, you know, if you were Nairo Quintana, you could argue that you know, that is not precise enough. It's also instructions being delivered in several languages, and you know, it also relies on everyone having seen the flags. We know that riders are strewn all over the road. It relies on radio communication passing in a snowstorm or in a rainstorm at 2,700 metres altitude in a very remote part of the Alps, not the Dolomites. So, you know, this is really not acceptable. And I know the practicalities are very difficult. It's not as simple as bringing a safety car onto the course on a Formula One circuit. However, there needs to be a much more watertight, much more solid protocol in place for these kind of eventualities. And that is, you know, rather than saying that, as Patrick Lefebvre said, that Mara Venyi ought to resign, and rather than, you know, Venyi saying that Beppe Martinelli, the Astana direct sportive, is a liar, which had apparently happened yesterday. What really needs to happen here is for everyone to get together and constructively together discuss a way to avoid this happening in future.
But surely the way to stop it happening in future is you either if you decide to race, you race, and if you decide not to race, you don't race. The problem with a stage like this, and we see this time and time again with the Giro, and we've seen stages cancelled or rerouted, they decided to plough ahead with it on Tuesday, and once that decision's been taken, it's then very, very hard, as you're saying, to communicate a change of plan midway through the race. Even harder than saying, okay, you know, if you're going to neutralise, then you have to neutralise entirely and say everybody stop on the road where you are, and then set them off again at an agreed point, having reinstated the time gap. Had they done that, and they could possibly have done that, it would have led to a little bit of a delay and perhaps a lot of standing around while they argued about it. But the riders could have got into the cars, could probably have got down. Well, having said that, there's only two team cars, isn't there? So you've got, in some cases, 8 or 9 riders. You know, logistically, it is a complete headache. They didn't allow themselves enough time to take into consideration what might happen, and so they tried to wing it. But surely the answer can't be a day after the event for the team managers to decide what the outcome should be and all decide that Quintana should be docked time. There is no provision for that in the rules.
This is what's most unpalatable. I mean, there needs to be strong leadership from the Giro organisers and the UCI, who are obviously overseeing the race and you know, the race is following their rules, and there hasn't been an awful lot of leadership. The noise and the sort of clamour that's followed has all come from the team directors. That's normal, that's understandable, but there doesn't seem to be any real strong leadership coming from anywhere else. And you know, we had a bit of a controversy at the Tour last year as well, of course, Tour de France on stage 1, where there was again, a lack of clarity about what would happen when the Orica Green Edge bus was stuck under the finish line. And at one point, the finish line was moved 3 kilometres down the road. Then it was changed, and there was a big crash, which some blamed on the lack of clarity, the fact that some riders thought they were racing to finish at 3 kilometres. There just needs to be clarity. As Daniel's saying, there needs to be precision and clarity. Decisions have to be made and then stood by.
I mean, Rich, we've also talked about, we've talked a lot in the past about vested interest, conflicts of interest in terms of doping. You know, is it correct that a race director, so Mauro Venni is the figurehead of the Giro d'Italia, he's responsible for the promotion of the event, for its, you know, for the success of the Giro d'Italia as a race. Is it reasonable that he is taking decisions is trying to enforce decisions which subsequently have to go through a UCI commissaire, which subsequently have to go through a race radio announcer? You know, should Venni and should RCS really be taken out of the equation there? Because Venni, obviously, you know, last year this very same stage was called off. It was a complete disaster because the Gavia was called off, the Stelvio was called off, and it was terrible for the race. And yesterday, there is no doubt that would have played on his mind, that it's everything has to be done to make this stage go ahead.
This is you're highlighting something that is certainly a flaw here. You know, in Formula One, Bernie Ecclestone is in charge. That's a bad example. But there should be, the chief commissaire should be the person making the decisions, and really the Giro organisers should be deferring to the chief commissaire, who's in charge of applying the UCI rules to that race. But there's this is cycling all over, isn't it? There is this.
But in terms of the damage done to an event and the standing of the event and the credibility of the race, yesterday's event was actually, you know, what played out on the stage on Tuesday this year actually portrays cycling in a better light than it does when they reroute or cancel, or when the riders take it on themselves to neutralise. Like in the 2010 Tour, when Andy Schleck slipped on the slippery descent in the Ardennes, and Fabian Cancellara
the chief commissaire Cancellara wasn't there yesterday. It would have been different if he'd been there. I can guarantee that.
Exactly. So Fabian Cancellara took the decision, really, having spoken to other riders in the race, to neutralise the bunch. And I think, was there one or two riders still ahead? I think
Chavanel
was still away, wasn't he? And but the race behind was all neutralised. Yesterday's stage, Tuesday's stage, was actually a fantastic race. And we can argue about whether Quintana should have gained 2 minutes, 3 minutes, or 4 minutes. But as a sporting spectacle, and in terms of, you know, we talk so much about the kind of the grainy, gritty, epic nature of racing in the elements, I'm not in any way taking away from the fact that the riders probably experienced severe discomfort and, you know, fear on the descent. Cold, dangerous, slippery, wet, you know, barely able to brake. That should not be taken lightly. But if we're talking about a sport for spectators on the television and for sponsors and for the kind of furtherment of the sport as a commercial spectacle, then yesterday was fantastic.
I mean, I'm remembering as well, 2009, the Giro, there was an incident of neutralisation, wasn't there? And perhaps a crucial factor then was that on the finishing circuit, Daniel, you're looking puzzled. You remember? They neutralised, it was deemed to be very slippy.
The criterium in Milan.
Yeah, in the finish, yeah. And Lance Armstrong was riding that race, and when somebody like that is riding, sometimes decisions are made in favour of the riders, and there is no patron at the Giro. They're quite inexperienced riders. An Uran, a Quintana isn't somebody who's going to stand up and say, right guys, this is what's going to happen today. He's not Bernardino yet. So that's perhaps a factor too. Lots of people obviously reminiscing about 1988 and Andy Hampson when he won the Giro on the same roads, in far worse conditions, in fact. The snow was far more severe. The clothing wasn't as good. Not to dismiss at all the complaints that the riders have made, because some of them are extremely valid, and riders' safety should be a priority. But we have seen riders race in conditions like this before. It is an occasional part of the sport. and you know, it's not something the riders enjoy, but certainly, as you say, Lionel, as a spectacle, it was a terrific stage.
Yeah, just one counterpoint to that, and it's something that has not been mentioned, has not been talked about enough, I think. Yesterday was yet another example, and this is the umpteenth example in the history of the Giro, of the Gavi and the Stelvio causing problems. And you know, we all get gooey about
the Dolomites.
No, not the Dolomites, not the Dolomites. We all get gooey about how, you know, wonderful you know, these exceedingly high epic climbs are, particularly those two. But the main problem with the Gavi and the Stelvio is that there is no alternative when things go wrong. You can't reroute through those valleys. You have to go over those climbs, or the stage has to be cancelled. And that was also a factor yesterday. I think they probably, it was borderline as to whether it should have gone ahead or not, but as far as the organisation was concerned, having had the cancellation last year, it was really almost no option for them to cancel those stages, and certainly those climbs, because there is no other option.
It's going to have a big say, though, isn't it, now on the overall outcome of the race. I mean, we'll look back, and particularly if the sports directors and the organisers and the UCI all come to a decision to, in some way, curtail the advantage that Quintana took. I still can't, you know, by the time you're listening to this podcast, the decision may well have been taken on that, but I still can't see how that can be right. How can you arbitrarily, even if you take into account, well, we think he's made, you know, he's gained a minute, say, on that descent, to dock him that minute, you know, it's without precedent, it's without provision in the rules. It sets a precedent for the future and for other races to be kind of altered after the fact. I think you either decide the results from Tuesday's stage don't count at all and you reinstate Rigoberto Urán in the pink jersey, or you leave them as they are. You can't have a kind of halfway house.
Or Quintana is disqualified. If the race commissaires, if the race radio announcers' word is gospel and they're effectively enforcing a rule there and it's contravened by someone, then someone should be disqualified from the race.
Yeah, and then we open up the sort of the possibility of the Court of Arbitration for Sport coming in, and I think that will inevitably lead to some kind of rewriting of the rules to take into account this kind of situation, because at the moment, if you take the UCI's rule, which I read out a little while ago, it's loose enough that any interpretation could be taken by the commissaires. They have the right and responsibility to call the results as they see it, and I don't think the sports directors and the teams or even the riders really can say afterwards, well, you know, revise events so that they come up with a, you know, it may feel like the right outcome, but unless it's kind of made, there's a provision for it in the rules, I just don't see how it can be you know, how it can fairly go ahead. Say you dock Quintana 1 minute and Urán wins the Tour of Italy by 5 seconds, and I mean, whichever way you cut it, it could lead to a farcical final few days.
I mean, disqualification for Quintana would obviously be unbelievably harsh and unprecedented as well. I can't see that happening at all, and it is very unsatisfactory. But the one thing I would say is that on the basis of that stage, Quintana should win the Giro. I mean, he is suffering from cold. He's apparently had an ear infection, but he has been looking better and better. And finally, we saw him do what we know he can do and climb beautifully. As I mentioned at the start, Ryder Hesjedal's performance to hang on like grim death to his back wheel was remarkable. It makes you wonder as well what might have been for him, who he lost a lot of time, of course, on the opening day in Belfast when Dan Martin fell off in the team time trial. Podium might still be a possibility for him, perhaps, but you know, that was an extraordinary performance by him as well, to hold on to a rider of Quintana's ability. And I think it also backed up something Daniel has said about Rigoberto Urán, who put in a phenomenal performance to win the time trial, but is he the complete package when it comes to a Grand Tour? I know he's done a lot of work on his time trialing in the winter with Specialized, I think, but has his climbing perhaps suffered? Has he ever been in the top rank of climbers with a Quintana, for example? Certainly a good climber, as all the Colombian riders are, but he's not somebody who we've seen performances like the one that we saw from Quintana on Tuesday. We've not seen that sort of performance from Urán too often.
No, I think he's set his stall out fairly clearly going into the big mountain stages, you know, with Europa and Monte Campione, and then further into the Dolomites. Sorry, Alps, Daniel.
We should point out the Dolomite Alp discussion is Daniel is the self-appointed Dolomite police, and he's, as some of you will know, Daniel's the esteemed author of Mountain High and Mountain Higher, the definitive books about mountains and cycling. I think we'd agree with that, wouldn't we, Daniel? I mean, but so Daniel, can you tell us? Well, we need to understand.
Very difficult. I'll post a diagram on Cycling Podcast Twitter feed.
How can you be so critical of commentators for getting it wrong if you can't even describe it?
Do you want precise grid reference? Do you want Ordnance Survey coordinates? Anyway, move on. What are we talking about?
Well, I was going to say that Juran had set his stall out to ride a very kind of measured, take a very measured passage through the mountain stages and not try and get lured into a dangerous game chasing Quintana, who's a lot more explosive than he is. He looked like he would let Quintana go and then limit his losses. And when Quintana was back at sort of 2.5-3 minutes, that looked like quite a sensible strategy, but obviously now Quintana's made significant gains and is, you know, unless Juran somehow has a remarkable mountain time trial on, I think, Friday, Quintana's going to be very, very difficult to overhaul.
The Cycling Podcast, interviews and analysis. We've got the big talking points covered.
Daniel, let's carry on talking about the Giro. We're also going to hear back from Daniel in the final part of the show about his trip to the Pyrenees, that's in the Pyrenees, isn't it? The Pyrenees, it's not in the Dolomites. And we're going to hear about his trip to the Pyrenees with the young Frenchman of Francaise de Jeu. I think he had a really nice time. He's certainly come back looking healthy, glowing. He's glowing. But Daniel, any more thoughts on the Giro in the meantime?
One of the big stories at the weekend was Fabio Aru's win at Monte Campione. Obviously, the Monte Campione stage was included this year, as well as the previous day's Europa stage in tribute to Marco Pantani, who died 10 years ago. Italy has been waiting 10 years for successor to Pantani. Nibali has taken on that mantle to a certain extent, but Aru has long been billed as certainly a very precocious climbing talent, predominantly a climber, also a reasonable ruler, and he really came of age at Monte Campione, attacking not very far from where Pantani dropped Pavel Tonkov in the famous battle in 1998 Giro, he showed a lot of class and he showed a lot of resilience in the Giro. It's not just been one exceptional performance, and he has sustained a very, very high level of performance throughout the race and really filled a hole for Astana, who lost Scarponi early on. But, you know, you do worry for Aru because there will be a lot of hype now in Italy. There certainly was the day after his victory. But he certainly has all the prerequisites to be a very strong major tour contender in the next few years. Where his future lies, I'm not quite sure. I mean, Astana have had a few problems this year. There's talk of their sort of Italian contingent disbanding slightly next year. Perhaps Giuseppe Martinelli, there's at the few, the direct sportive, a few question marks over his future, question marks over where Aru will eventually end up. And there are Italian teams. Cannondale next year are very likely to have a lot of budget left over. They're going to lose Basso, I think, and they're going to lose Sagan. So not a rich team, but they have got a bit of money to spend. So it wouldn't surprise me if Aru might end up there.
What about Domenico Pozzovivo, who looked great at Europa and then not so great the following day? And, I mean, he looked like he was going to match Quintana, kind of pedal stroke for pedal stroke, and
he looked better than Quintana initially until the last few days, really. He looked the stronger rider, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he's certainly been sort of leapfrogged, really, by Aru in terms of, you know, the pecking order of the Italians. But then, yeah, it'll be interesting. I think Pozzovivo maybe perhaps going to be a bit better in the time trial than Aru, maybe.
I mean, Pozzovivo's pulled out the odds, quite astonishing time trial in the Vuelta, he certainly did. You know, looking at them, Aru's a much taller guy, he should be much more powerful on the flat, you'd expect him to, but obviously we're talking about a mountain time trial on Friday's Monte Grappa. It'll be interesting to see. I mean, it's a steep climb the way they're going up Monte Grappa. Pozzovivo should go okay there. I don't think there'll be major differences between them.
We've talked a lot about you know, Nibali, you mentioned him as a successor to Pantani, you know, a very talented rider but lacking that sort of star quality. Do you think Aru has that? Do you know much about his personality?
He talks fairly well, he's fairly level-headed, he doesn't have the edge that Pantani had, or that, for instance, he's certainly no Ricardo Rico.
That's probably a good thing.
Yeah, he certainly doesn't seem to display the worst qualities of Rico. But he's Sardinian, which is, you know, his sort of USP, the thing that really distinguishes him from Italian riders, big name Italian riders of the past. Sardinia does not produce a lot of professional cyclists. In fact, they've hardly produced any professional cyclists in the last 15 years. There was a sprinter, Alberto Lodo, who rode for Lampre for a few years, won a few races, but apart from him, the cupboard has been fairly bare. And Sardinia, of course, is recovering as an island, as a place. It was very much hit last year by landslides, and you know, which really kind of blighted the whole of one side of the island. And you know, Aru's success at the Giro has been seen, it's been Greece as a way of kind of uniting the people who, you know, are still having a lot of problems after that last year.
This is the Cycling Podcast with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney and Daniel Free.
Final part of today's podcast, and Daniel, you're back from the Pyrenees. Tell us about Francis Dujeux. I think it was their pre-tour camp. So was it the tour team that was there, Thibaut Pinot and friends?
Yeah, there were about 13 riders there in total, which is pretty much their long list for the Tour de France. There was their long list for the Tour de France plus one, which is Kenny Ellison, the young climber who is not going to do the tour, but he was there anyway. And obviously the riders who were still in contention in theory, who are riding the Giro, so that includes Nasser Bouhanni, who's obviously had a very, very successful Giro. And yeah, the purpose of the training camp was really to look at some tour stages. They went to do the stage finishing at Pla d'Adet one day, and the following day we were at Hautacam. They had a good old Elisonde and Pinot had the two sort of star climbers. Francis Dujeux had a good old ding dong up there, really raced hard up Hautacam, and then the following day did some team time trial training.
They do realise there isn't a team time trial this year.
I hope they do realise that. Yeah, obviously,
like Nibali a couple of years ago thought there was a team time trial, didn't he, in 2011?
He did. He found out about midway through the first week that stage 8 wasn't the team time trial. The journalists had been puzzled, for the Italian journalists had all been absolutely puzzled about Nibali's optimism ahead of the time trial for the since the start of the race, and then the penny finally dropped that he thought it was a team trial, and that was why he was so optimistic. But yeah, going back to La France de Dijon, obviously a lot of scrutiny on Thibaut Pinot this year after his sort of disaster in the Pyrenees last year on the descent off the Port de Paillère in the first stage in the Pyrenees. Really lost his nerve, and there was a lot of press coverage of his troubles on descent, and a lot of talk about how he was going to fix them. A lot of efforts by his brother, who is also his coach, Julien, to find solutions to that problem. He's done various things this winter. He's been doing ice rally racing at Alpe d'Huez, of all places. He's been on the track in Magny-Cours in a rally car. He also, at the end of last summer, he had the good fortune to, bump into just an amateur cyclist on a descent somewhere down in the south of France in the Var, who had some great tips, he said. Gave him some fantastic tips, which helped him more than anything.
Absolutely bizarre.
Yeah. The feeling in the team now is that the problems have been solved, and also looking back, that rather than technical problems or even problems to do with a phobia of speed and descending, which is what they said at the time, that the problem really was a build-up of stress, of hype, of you know, the attention of the press media, and that he really just cracked at the first, you know, the first sort of hurdle, the first sign of anything going wrong. His nerve just just snapped, really. And they're very confident that that won't happen this year. He's more relaxed. He's been shielded a bit more from the media. His profile has probably dropped slightly. His thunder's been stolen to a certain extent by other young French riders. Barguil and Bardet have had a lot of publicity this year. So Pinot's been able to prepare for the Tour fairly quietly. He's on decent form. He had a knee problem early in the year, but he's overcome that. And he thinks he can finish in the top five of the Tour overall. I would suggest that 5th to 10th place would be a good ride for him, possibly a good ride and maybe a stage win in the Alps or Pyrenees as well.
I mean, it's sometimes hard to tell on these camps, or you know, it's a mistake to take too much from them, but when he and Elissonde, who is a good, very good climber, battled each other on Otacam, did you learn anything from that?
I think Pinot was taking it slightly easier than Elissonde. That Elissonde's had a tricky season. I mean, for those that don't know, he's also a very young French climber. I think he's 22 years old now. Rode extremely well last year in the Tour of Oman on the hard stage to the Green Mountain. And was rubbing shoulders with the likes of Chris Froome there, and has sort of struggled in recent months. The team say because they simply can't find races that suit him. I mean, he weighs 52 kilos. He's about 5'4", 5'5".
He makes Pots of Evil look like Marcel Kittel.
Yeah. And Elissonde has really, they say he needs long climbs, big climbs, but you rarely find them in 1 week stage races, and the only place you really find them is in major tours, and there are obviously only three major tours in the year. So Elissonde is very much kind of a work in progress and won't do the Tour this year. We'll do the Vuelta, but he obviously a very talented climber. I mean, those two were noticeably faster, probably about a minute or so faster on Hortacam than Arnaud Janssen, who's also a very good climber. And has done well in Tour mountain stages in the past.
They're having a good year, Francis Desjeux, and they're a team with a lot of kind of young bucks. They're not a team with very many experienced heads.
No.
But a lot of potential winners, potential leaders. What's the sort of chemistry like? Is that a problem? Is that a source of friction, perhaps, in that?
Well, they are quite a sort of boisterous bunch, and some of the older heads have retired in the last couple of years. Sandy Cazar has gone, and the sort of real steadying influence now is probably Jeremy Roy, who is not, I think he's still in his 20s himself, but is one of the more experienced riders. But there is a group there of sort of precocious young Frenchmen. Arthur Vichot is one, the French national champion. Arnaud Demar, who will probably do the Tour this year, and Thibaut Pinot. And it is quite a boisterous environment at times. In fact, there was a bit of an incident on the last day I was there during the time trial training, where one of the direct sportifs, Yvonne Madiot, didn't think that they were really concentrating very hard and gave him a bit of a stern talking to mid-session.
And there was a lot of banter between Vichot and Thibaut Pinot on Otacam. I seem to remember you telling me about that, Daniel. Sounded like fun.
So Pinot and Vichot, both from broadly the same region in France, on the east side of France, near Besançon, and they've sort of grown up together as cyclists, trained together, obviously have a very sort of good and sort of combative camaraderie between them. And Pinot and Elissonde had obviously got to the top of Otacam sometime ahead of Vichot. Vichot's a decent climber himself, certainly for someone of his build. He's quite a chunky guy, but they reached the summit 3 or 4 minutes ahead of him, and Vichot arrived on the summit to catcalls from Pinot, and I think he was greeted with the words, "You're a disgrace to the French national champion's jersey."
Vichot, his uncle Frederick Vichot, was one of the best descenders of the 1980s. He was a teammate of Sean Kelly, stage winner at the Tour de France, a very renowned descender. I don't think that they speak Frederick Vichot and Arthur Vichot, but he would have been perhaps a good guy to speak to Thibaut Pinot at some point. Shame they don't talk anymore.
Not as good as the Weekend Warrior.
Not as good as this amateur they managed. Just don't touch the brakes, Thibaut. Anyway, that's about all for this week. finish this podcast, I'd like just like to extend a little invite to five lucky or otherwise listeners who might fancy in London next Tuesday, which is the 3rd of June, I am launching my new book, Etap, which is 20 sort of untold stories of great or defining or interesting stages of the Tour de France. The book is published next week, but I'm having a launch in London on Tuesday evening, and I've got about five places available at the launch. So if you'd like to come, please send me an email, richardbmoore@btinternet.com.
You'll be inundated now with fan mail, knickers.
This is almost a test to see if anybody actually listens to the end. Right. See if you fancy it. Tuesday evening, 3rd of June, London, as I say, about five places, first come, first served.
Excellent.
That includes you, Lionel, because you've not RSVP'd yet, I noticed.
I've not had an invite yet, Richard. No. Still not had an invite. Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yes, I'd like to come.
Is it true that you two are going to do a duet, My Endless Love?
Just on that subject, we're also launching the fourth volume of the cycling anthology on June 10th. I'm not stealing your thunder, Richard. Yeah, that's also in London. It's at the Look Mum No Hands, but the Hackney branch of Look Mum No Hands on Tuesday, June the 10th. Keep an eye out on Twitter. Follow at Cycling Anthol. Further details on that. I think that's open to anyone to come along, as long as they can squeeze in.
Well, that's all for this week. Thanks very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
And thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, Rich.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.